Hi there. Welcome to Sound Healing Radio. My name's David Gibson, and today we're here with Bruce Rawls. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, welcome, welcome. You know, what we often do is we'll set an intention for the show, and then when you're speaking, I normally go back to that intention. Any thoughts as to what might be good?
Well, how about holding the intention for healing duality?
Healing duality.
That covers a lot of ground.
So what would that... So, okay, let's hold that frequency of healing dualities for a second. Oh. It's interesting, when I do that, I get a pyramid of the two dualities and then down to like a root.
Aha. That sounds good. Yeah, as you know, I'm a fan of pyramids too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the metaphor of the pyramid with the apex where polarization is reconciled is a great one.
Mm-hmm.
And chosen for good reason for our founding ancestors of the country that put that together. Obviously, there's plenty of interesting comments that can be made about the symbolism of the Great Seal and all kinds of things like that. But the pyramid's kind of a neat metaphor because it integrates, if you will, the earth, air, fire, water aspects of consciousness. And the middle is the alchemy of the One.
Mm-hmm. So have you you've studied the Great Pyramid?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics. I got to visit there in the fall of 92 with a bunch of friends and had an incredible trip with Greg Braden, and I think there were 21 of us all together that got to go up and down the Nile and up Mount Sinai and inside the pyramid, and had some pretty neat experiences there.
Did anything happen?
Well, that's another thing that kind of ties into the sound healing, and since I know you're a big fan of that, as I am, the obvious benefits that working with sound can bring to a consciousness. One of the experiences that we all took turns doing toning or making sounds from our vocal cords in the granite box that is usually called a sarcophagus, although I'm convinced that there was never any pharaoh buried there or any mummies, because at least in terms of the conventional theory that Egyptologists use of having the body moved in the box in place into the room, well, the box is bigger than the opening into the so-called king's chamber, so that kind of throws that theory out of the water. Mm-hmm. But what we found is the resonance of that structure, both the box and the room that it sits within, and then the entire structure, network of internal passageways, which I was fascinated with even back in high school days, in the early 70s, was calculating the frequencies and harmonics of all the resonant passageways. And there's some really interesting harmonics there that happen. And rather than get bogged down into the math of it, which I've probably had to dig out to share with you anyway, the experiential effect, though, that, and I'm not unique in this, I've heard other people give similar accounts of, is that when I was toning in what's called the sarcophagus, the granite box there, it sounded like a thousand voice choir, coming through my voice, not really from it, but through it more appropriately. And I've talked to other people that have had similar types of experience. It's kind of hard to describe, but it feels like there's sort of a dimensional portal there that opens
when you
up.
Hit the resonant frequency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was extremely quick to hit. Couldn't have been more than a second or two that I discovered what the pitch was that vibrated very resoundly.
I did the same thing. I found the resonant frequency really quickly.
Yeah, I think we had this conversation a month or two ago before I came down to thank you again, by the way, for being part of your wonderful conference a few weeks ago.
Thanks.
In Southern California, that was a really wonderful opportunity to meet lots of neat kindred souls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know, it was really interesting because it not only seemed, I mean, when you find that frequency, it seems to resonate the rest of the room really uniquely as well.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, it felt like it was not only resonating in my body, but also in the box and in the room, and then I could hear it echoing up and down the structure that's called the Grand Gallery, and back and forth, and we all had an opportunity to do that, and that was pretty powerful, pretty profound. I'm convinced that we don't really need to go to Egypt to do that. We can do that internally, and in terms of just creating, as you very appropriately pointed out, the intention. That intention can set up that field just by itself, and it's nice to have the last of the seven wonders of the world to to resonate with, but it's not required, so to speak.
You know, there was one thing that I found that was really interesting, because I was in the King's Chamber for about 4 hours,
and
I found that when I would tone and then stop, the reverb in the room had binaural beats in it.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
Yeah, so I would go, woo, and I would stop, and it would go, woo, 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 woo.
Uh-huh. Sort of like a heterodyning effect?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. I don't know if I experienced that, but the experience of just the qualitative experience, it's just, hard to describe, but the closest I can come to it is like a thousand voice choir singing through me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure probably other people describe that sort of experiential thing in different terms, but it was unique.
So you do sacred. One of your main things is sacred geometry, right?
Uh huh. Yeah, I have a lot of fun with that. Even ever since about high school days, there were two books that kind of got me into all that. One was Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid, which, as you might imagine, fascinated me with not only the lore of the pyramid going back millennia, and then another one called This Living Earth by David Cavagnaro. And both of them had references to the golden section, which is also known as the phi proportion or the golden ratio, the golden mean, goes divine proportion. It goes by a lot of names that I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with. And so at the time, before the term sacred geometry, I guess, was in vogue, I devoured everything I could find in the local library where I grew up in Livermore, California, and then went off to school to UC Davis and pretty much exhausted everything I could find in the Shields Library there as well. And it was a lifelong passion and inquiry into, what is it about the proportion that is such that the ratio of dividing something in such a way that the small compared to the large is the same as the large compared to the sum of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And if you work that out mathematically, it gives you a proportion such that if you assign the ratio to the Greek letter phi or phi, phi plus 1 is equal to phi squared. And when you work through the math of that, it turns out that the quadratic formula plugs right in, and you get 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, which works out to approximately 1.618, and then you can go out to infinity with the decimal points. It's like 1.618033988874, and it goes on literally to infinity with this irrational number that continues to define exactly this mystical proportion that has to do with interconnectedness. And to me, that's how I look at it, is it's really a proportion that gives us a relationship that we can use symbolically and metaphorically to remember that there really is no separation, that we have in this material world metaphors and reminders that can bring us home, so to speak, to that remembrance of oneness. And then that brings us to the awareness of compassion and kindness and mutual understanding that allows us to go beyond grievances and annoyances and all that kind of stuff.
Before we get into that part, I want to go back into the phi ratio. Now, my understanding is it's in every bit of life on Earth.
Yep, I think that's a pretty accurate statement.
Uh-huh.
Certainly in biological sense, if we were to restrict our conversation to just biological life that has DNA,
uh-huh.
The cross-section of the DNA molecule has a pentagon, a double pentagon, really, or a decagon, if you will. Uh-huh. It's a 10-sided structure, which is really made out of two five-sided figures rotated exactly halfway. And then within that basically is the cross section looking down the helical spiral of the DNA. And each turn, each one complete turn of the DNA spiral, the helical spiral, is 34 angstroms long by 21 angstroms wide or across. So there you have interesting, you know, it could be in any numbers that give you that proportion, but that proportion just happens to be two of the numbers called Fibonacci numbers that, again, probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with. And
yeah, the Fibonacci, my understanding of the Fibonacci is it's nature's way of getting to the golden mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yes, exactly, exactly.
Like because nature can only branch off one branch at a time.
Right.
It's like by the time it branches off enough times, then it gets finally to the golden mean.
Exactly, uh-huh. Exactly. And the way you achieve that mathematically is you start with one and one, mm-hmm. and then the sum of each, the next number in the series is always the sum of the previous two.
Mm-hmm.
So one and one make two, one and two make three, two and three make five, three and five make eight, and then you go on from there to 13, 21, 34, and there's the 21-34 ratio,
mm-hmm.
Which is the number of angstroms in that proportion.
Oh.
And it goes to 55, 89, 144, which is an interesting number, and then on to infinity. And the closer you, the farther out on that sequence you go and you take the ratio of any two consecutive terms, the closer it gets to the exact value at infinity of the golden ratio, given that quadratic formula I just gave.
Now, the golden ratio is also in non-living things as well.
Of course, of course.
Yeah.
Things that we would call non-living anyway, the
uh-huh.
mineral kingdom.
Uh-huh.
For example, if you pick up an iron pyrite crystal, you'll find that it has either cubic or dodecahedral geometry. And a dodecahedron is a shape that Plato, who was credited with coining the name for the five regular polyhedra, which is a fancy mathematical term for things with many sides. And the regular polyhedra that most people are familiar with is a cube, which is just six squares. The other four of that five are made out of either triangles, which is the tetrahedron, which is a three-sided pyramid, the octahedron, which is an eight-sided pyramid, and then the or double pyramid, if you will, and then the icosahedron, which is a more rounded shape. And dual to that, or if you take the midpoints of each of the faces of this 20-sided shape called the icosahedron, and connect them all together, you get the shape called a dodecahedron.
Mm-hmm.
And a dodecahedron is the first four, earth, air, fire, and water, getting back to the alchemical symbolism again, the integration to...
How many sides does the dodecahedron have?
The dodecahedron has 12 sides.
Okay.
And that's exactly what the Greek word means, is 12-sided, or dodeca for 12 and hedron for side.
How many sides does each side have?
Oh, well, each of the sides of each of the faces has
uh-huh.
five sides.
Five sides, and there's 12 of those.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. And so because of that, the dodecahedral shape, each face being a pentagon or a five-sided shape, if you take the lines that make up a pentagon and connect them all together, you end up inscribing a five-pointed star, a pentagram. And if you look at the proportions of the pentagon and the pentagram and all the little pentagrams that make the inner pentagrams, because it's a fractal. You keep connecting all the dots, and pretty soon you get smaller and smaller pentagrams and pentagons and pentagrams and alternating back and forth. In fact, it actually kind of reminds me of the Star Trek episode of Tribbles,
mm-hmm.
which if any of your listeners remember that episode where Captain Kirk and his crew discovered these little critters that were born pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
if you look at the symbol of the five-pointed star, and you draw this out, you draw the five-pointed star, and inside that's a pentagon, and inside that's another pentagon, and each one is inverted a pentagram, but it's almost like the symbol of pregnancy or fertility, if you will. It's almost like the fetus in the womb drawn inside the abdomen, and then that is you know, contains within it the seed of yet another generation.
Right.
So metaphorically, the pentagram and the golden ratio, which are compose all the proportions of the pentagram and the pentagon in that nested structure, give you that metaphor for interconnectedness and relatedness. That,
you know, it's interesting. Randy Masters once said that the universe is actually in the shape of a dodecahedron.
Right. I've read some reports on the web.
How could they figure that out?
I don't know. That one kind of boggles me, too. But I like the idea. I mean, it's a fun idea. I'm not attached to it, but it's kind of an interesting thing. And it wouldn't surprise me. You know, I mean, that's Plato's element for spirit or ether is the dodecahedron. And interestingly enough, I mentioned, I think, earlier that I grew up in Livermore, California. My dad was a supervisor on a cyclotron. And so I joke with people sometimes that I grew up in a nuclear family, literally and figuratively, around the table, the dinner table, we talk about, you know, isotopes and deuterium and neutrinos and things like that. So the interesting thing about the nuclear aspect of all this is that, on the subatomic scale, you have these particles that also have the sacred geometry proportions. In fact, one of the projects when I was in high school that they were working on was a project called Shiva, named after the Greek god of destruction, or in this case, annihilating matter to turn it into energy. And what they were doing was focusing 12 lasers in this prototype. I'm not sure if it ever got off the ground and started making energy, but this was the plan. And one of the physicists that was working there was a friend of the family, and he worked diligently on it for a number of years. And the Shiva project basically had 12 lasers focused on this deuterium pellet that would implode and then give off all this energy. Well, again, I'm not sure if it ever worked or not, but the idea was they were going to use, guess what, a dodecahedron topology to focus these lasers. And so they had a little plexiglass model in the lab journal that my dad would bring home. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And that was about the time I was reading the Tompkins book on the Great Pyramid and the Living Earth book that showed about the fiddle ferns and chambered nautilus shells and all these things in nature, this wonderful, beautiful coffee table book with all these pictures from nature that showed the natural, plant and animal kingdoms with the spirals that were made of Fibonacci progressions and so forth. So it kind of really piqued my curiosity. It's like, okay, there's something going on here that, if a structure that's millennia old had encoded into its proportions the apothem, if you will, of it's basically the from the top to the middle of one side of the Great Pyramid is called the apothem. And if you take that and divide it by one half of the base sides, which is where that line would cut the base side in half of any side of the four sides of the pyramid, that proportion is also the golden ratio, which means that you could take those two triangles that you just, since you cut one face in half, and you can fold it over and make a golden rectangle, as it's called. Mm-hmm. And that golden rectangle is the basis for the cross-section of the Parthenon. It's what frames the Last Supper that Da Vinci was so well known for, and so many other works of art that he did, and many other Renaissance artists. You can take three golden rectangles and stack them together and make the UN building. So a lot of people through history have modeled that harmonious and beautiful proportion from examples in nature that use it because it's aesthetically more pleasing, and it's that quality of I think intrinsic interconnectedness and interrelatedness and ultimately oneness that it basically is a reminder that the notion of separation is ultimately bogus. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a training wheel or a stepping stone to get back to that awareness.
Mm-hmm. There's also one other component that is really interesting about the golden ratio, and that is when you're transmitting love, your heart actually puts out a sound. The heartbeat it has a sound that has harmonics in it that are in golden mean ratio.
Absolutely, yes. I'm glad you brought that up because a dear friend of mine named James Barrett, if you go to silentgospel.com, you'll see some of his work. He's done work with a fellow named Dan Winter that a lot of people listening to the show are probably familiar with. And he and Dan developed a thing called a heart link, which has since gone off into what Dan's working on in Europe with a fellow named Frank Bovenkamp with a heart tuner. And then in this country, that got picked up by the heart math folks, and they're working with a number of technologies using that same idea. And the idea of that is that you can use the EKG waveform or the electrocardiogram, that, as you say, the song of the heart really is what it is, an electrical song, if you will. And if you take that information, rather than in the time domain, which is what people usually think of it as a little blips on the oscilloscope, but turn it into the frequency domain, which is basically looking at the whole range of sounds and seeing that, if you will, in somewhat real time. Anybody who has a graphic equalizer on their stereo or has the little display that shows the low tones and then the high tones and the mid tones and the little LEDs that jump up and down in response to the different bands of frequencies, if you can imagine taking the heartbeat and getting a display analogous to that, that's basically what you're doing with the EKG when you do what's called a fast Fourier transform or turning it from time domain into frequency domain. That's the technical jargon for that. And what that does is it allows you to look at the harmonics of the heartbeat. And it turns out that, as you point out, David, and I think it's really cool, and not just cool intellectually, but cool experientially, because when James hooked me up to his HeartLink device a few years ago and I first tried this, it was like, oh, that's the aha moment, because you feel it. When you feel that sense of presence and oneness and peace just a love, all the different words that we could describe it. What happens is, instead of this sort of random, chaotic-looking jumble waveform of the frequency waveform that you're looking at in pretty much real time, it's, close to real time, you discover that your harmonics make this beautiful cascade of, it looks like a comb, little spikes that are evenly spaced and beautifully arranged with equal spacing. And the spacing between those harmonics, these very sharp peaks of energy in the frequency domain, turns out to be the square root of the golden ratio. So there's that number again popping up in the heartbeat of a person who is tuned in. And it also turns out, according to the work that Dan Winter and other researchers have done, is when you're in that state of entrainment, you can tune into not only other people, but they've hooked up things like an oak tree, I think it was, or some kind of a large tree, I think they had hooked up to similar equipment. Now, obviously, they don't have a heartbeat, but they have electrical signals that can be measured and applied the same technique in the frequency domain and looked at. And it turns out that when a person is feeling the sense of rapport with a tree or any other object, then the entrainment not only happens within the person, but also from individual to individual, this sort of phase entrainment. And it's pretty cool.
did it happen with the tree as well?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So they were actually able to measure the entrainment with what we would consider.
So I'm sorry,
a different
species. The signals you were getting out of the tree, they had the golden ratio.
I'm not sure if those were also in the same harmonic series, but there was a correlation anyway in terms of the waveforms and between the person who was in that really peaceful state.
It's really really interesting when if you take that out, which it might be in relation to what you talk about as far as compassion, but it just seems like if that ratio is when you're transmitting love.
Uh-huh.
That just somehow, and I'm just putting this together at this moment. Somehow that means that in every that's like maybe that's the way love. I mean that shows that there's love in everything.
Absolutely, and that we literally can't, as they say, pluck a flower without troubling a star.
Uh-huh.
I love that a lot of these quotes and remind us that there's no difference between us. I mean, our perception. We've just been reading, my wife and I, the latest Eckhart Tolle book since he's been featured on Oprah, which I think is a wonderful milestone for our planet. That somebody with that depth of insight about letting go of egoic consciousness can be on a 4-week program on Oprah's website. Yay!
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty cool. The things like that give me not only hope but enthusiasm for thinking in terms of how can we let go of not only individually but collectively the belief that polarity somehow is going to get us anywhere.
Well, that's like the basic concept that a lot of people don't know about is there's a whole movement of non-duality.
Yep.
Called the non-dual movement.
Mm-hmm.
and there's a Gangaji and Adyashante and
absolutely.
You know, the basic concept, of course, is just is the same thing as Eckhart Tolle.
Yes.
That if you don't have to study. It's not a long process. You have to learn.
Exactly.
To,
it's unlearning.
To be able to get to perfect presence.
Right. Yeah, those are two good examples. Gangaji and Adyashanti are wonderful examples of that presence and that knowledge. I've been going through the Course in Miracles again with great enthusiasm, and one of the lessons I have that I'm looking at on my computer screen right now is a review of previous workbook lessons, and I'm going through them one at a time. And this one fits perfectly. It says, "Everything I think or say or do touches all the universe. I'm alone in nothing."
You know, that it makes me wonder, because now that there's this whole thing about quantum physics and quantum mechanics.
Exactly, the entanglement.
How I haven't heard anybody talk about how sacred geometry ties into that whole field.
Well, you know, I think it has to, because what happens is, like you say, the entanglement really has to do with our awareness, and our awareness works in form, in terms of our understanding of it here, but in truth, you know, we're beyond form, and yet it manifests within form. So the form is sort of like the shadow on the wall. That's sort of like the smoking gun, if you will, of the results of the cause that is our thoughts and feelings and awareness and so forth. So I think the sacred geometry, again, like the example of the heart entrainment being then the square root of phi harmonics, I think that's not the cause so much as a reflection of an inner harmony that we can use as sort of an after-the-fact barometer for an indicator that there's been some alignment and some attunement with non-resistance, if you will.
You know, the biggest aha that I ever had after doing a sacred geometry class, I went camping, and I was looking up at the stars. And normally you look at the stars and you go, whoa, what a cacophony. This looks like it just looks like a million stars that have no pattern at all. And then I realized, no, this is the most ordered thing in the universe. I mean, there's like an incredible amount of order. In fact, all of the stars are laid out in precise sacred geometry pattern, which is exactly the same sacred geometry pattern that you find in yourself.
Yes. In fact, the spiral is a perfect example of that. We could talk about the spirals in the galaxy, the spirals in our inner ear, the spirals in seashells and ferns, in the ocean and the currents on our planet, and so many different places. And the spiral is such a wonderful metaphor for the growth and evolution. It's really unfolding, if you will, or unlearning, to get back to our previous conversation, and allowing and decreasing the resistance to what already is, in a sense. And I think that's a great metaphor. Another thing that, in addition to the stars that you mentioned, right here in our local solar system, there's a fellow named John Martineau, and I've got some pictures on my website, if I could mention that. It's geometrycode.com.
Yes.
And there is a whole series I did that was just kind of fun playing around with a program called Pavre. And I took the work of John Martineau, who is a brilliant fellow. I got to meet him about 4 summers ago when he was out visiting from England. He worked with Keith Critchlow and a whole bunch of interesting folks and came up with a set of models of the solar system that is absolutely stunning and amazingly accurate. If you go to the gallery page on my website, which is geometrycode.com, and click on the Martineau link there, you'll see a series of a dozen images that were all inspired by his wonderful little line art sketches and a little book of coincidence, and there's links to that on there as well. And the idea behind that is that you can take, essentially it's picking up where Kepler left off. Johannes Kepler was also a mystic who looked at the solar system from the eyes of wanting to see the interconnectedness of things and the divine order, if you will. And his passion was to find models of the solar system that tied into the realm of geometry. So if you look at the woodcuts that you can look on, you can find them on Wikipedia and various places. There's a series of actually a couple of woodcuts that show these platonic solids: the cube, the tetrahedron, icosahedron, dodecahedron, and tetrahedron. Well, anyway, those five. Maybe I'm mentioning them twice, but he showed how they could be nested inside spheres. spheres that represents the orbits of the planets. Well, this was, you know, several centuries ago. And Kepler was close. He was on the right track in terms of the concept. His model, if you do the math, which I've done, is not terribly accurate. So they're like 80-90%. So, yeah, interesting, but not very, very compelling in terms of the mathematics. However, John Martineau, using both intuition and a brilliant mind for looking at different universal models, came up with a series of, well, there's at least a dozen. Those are the only ones I've put in artistic form, but he's got in his book called A Little Book of Coincidence, and I understand there's actually a big book of coincidence, too, which I have yet to see, and I'd love to see. A friend of mine is telling me about that. He's got models of the solar system. For example, if you take the orbit of Uranus and the orbit of Saturn, and you approximate, again, we know that those are actually ellipses, and he's the one that figured those out, Kepler, that is. If you take the average of the major and minor axes of those ellipses and average them out of circles, which for most of the planets is pretty darn close, you discover that you can put an equilateral triangle within the outer, and then the sides of the equilateral triangle just exactly touch the orbit of Saturn on the inner orbit, and then exactly touch the orbit of Uranus on the outer orbit, and all you have is two circles and a triangle. And all those models are about 99.9% accurate. There are, some of them are 99.8, but most are like 99.9, 99.97, 98, 99. I mean, they're just incredibly accurate. So I have a series of images that show how, with simple shapes, and again, pictures a thousand words, but for example, the Mars-Jupiter relationship you can do with a square, and you take, if you can picture this, if you're not looking at the website, you can picture a circle that's centered on each corner of a square. And you have, so you have four circles, and they just touch each other. So you have four circles that just touch each other. And then in the middle, you have a space that you can fit another circle. And that circle would represent the orbit of Mars. And then around the square, if you wrap a circle around the square so that it just, the circle just touches the four corners of the square, that's the orbit of Jupiter. And again, these are like 99.9% accurate, so it's very accurate. So if I was a school teacher and I wanted to give kids a sense of how far away the planets are from each other, I now have, you know, would now have a set of models that would be extremely accurate, certainly to the accuracy of anything that we could do with compass and straight edge. And I'm thinking, wouldn't that be a cool playground layout? You know, have some jungle gyms that showed the actual orbits of the planets with giant ellipses that, you know, might cover an acre or two. And then on the ground, you could have a mosaic of the different geometric patterns that form these relationships, and they're really simple ones. There's a few that are three-dimensional. For example, the tetrahedron, which is the three-sided pyramid that probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with. If you take that, it's made out of four equilateral triangles. If you take the corners of that shape and lop it off, you have what's called a truncated tetrahedron, appropriately enough, and that's made out of four hexagons and four triangles, and they're all equal-sided. And if you wrap a sphere exactly around that inner shape, that's the orbit of Uranus, and then the orbit of the original tetrahedron before you lopped off the corners is the orbit of Neptune. And there's just a whole bunch of them like that. Another really beautiful one is a dodecahedron, that shape we already talked about, that's got the 12 pentagons. And if you put a sphere on each corner of this three-dimensional shape now, and to where those spheres just touch each other, you can fit another sphere on the inside, and that's the orbit of Venus. You can fit a sphere around those 20 spheres on the outside, and that's the orbit of Mars.
You know, it's interesting. I'm working on this whole virtual reality system where you can put images of sacred geometry inside an image of your body.
Yes, I was very blown away and impressed with the demo, the prototype you showed at the conference, and that's really cool.
So it makes me think. I mean, because you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about the different healing capacities of different geometric shapes, and you know, so for example, if we wanted to put something inside a physical, say you could look down in virtual reality and see your heart, and you wanted to put a sacred geometry image inside your heart, what would you put in there, and why?
Well, I think the heart, would relate very nicely, again, since we have that golden ratio connection with the feelings of compassion. And this is demonstrably shown time and time again that people that are, and I didn't try to make this happen. I was just over at James's house in Nevada City where I used to live, and he hooked me up to the HeartLink, and within a minute or two, it was like, he just said, oh, just, you know, kick back and relax and think of something really peaceful and really just, you know, one of your favorite reveries kind of thing. And, you know, as soon as I kind of got out of my head, if you will, and into my heart, voila, there were all those beautiful comb-shaped harmonics, and I'm feeling that right now. It's one of those things that once you experience that, you can tune into it again. Years ago, I got a biofeedback device back in the early 70s, the same kind of era I got into all this stuff, and I realized that I could tune into an alpha state whenever I wanted to once you practiced it a little bit. And the same kind of thing with the heart tuner. You can put yourself back in that state through intention, which is where we started off the hour, isn't it? And that intention automatically connects us with that. And so with that intention, we would then be guided to bring the appropriate shape, the appropriate colors, the appropriate sounds, maybe with ultrasound, into a technology like you're envisioning, which I think would be really cool. Yeah.
Now, as far as the different, you know, as far as sacred geometry and its relation to sound,
uh-huh.
You know, there's, I mean, I can give you a few ways that I know that it can be related. Of course, first of all, you can take the sides of any sacred geometry image, and that will create a musical interval.
Right, right. The and proportions.
Then, yeah, and then there's also, I used to have one of those Shambhala pyramids, one of those huge pyramids of that are like tubes with crystals on them,
uh-huh.
over my bed.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it's actually too activating, so I... It's like after not sleeping a lot, but we took it down.
I can relate that. I made a pyramid that was about 6 feet tall and 10 feet on the side. Had it in the backyard, and the first time I set that up, I had a chaise lounge, and this is when I lived with my folks in the early 70s. And I thought, oh, I'll go ahead and meditate on that for about 10 minutes, and next thing I know, 3 hours had gone by, and oh, I guess that does sort of dilate time a little.
It was interesting, though, but because after having been in the pyramid and really understanding how things resonate and the frequency of resonance, I was able to hear the frequency, the resonant frequency of the pyramid,
uh-huh.
after sleeping under it.
Wow, neat.
And
neat.
Then it was really interesting, after we took the pyramid down,
uh-huh.
I could still, for about 2 to 3 months, it was etherically still there.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. I played around again years ago with Kirlian photography, and they had a thing called the phantom leaf effect and also a phantom limb effect, where the energy of the person's auric field, photosphere, whatever you want to call it, could still be projected into the space where a limb or a leaf or, you know, whatever was before, you know, being cut off or whatever. And you can, I have a slide, a 35 millimeter slide of that I took with it, you know, playing around with just a leaf of a plant and, you know, taking a little tiny chunk out. And sure enough, there was, it wasn't as bright as the so-called actual leaf, but the phantom or virtual energetic leaf was still showing evidence of its pattern there.
So there's another aspect that, which just blew me away, that I just was the biggest aha I had at our Sound Healing Conference in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And that was when Elizabeth Bauer was, she showed a cymatic visual, you know, of sound vibrating sand or powder on a plate.
Mm-hmm.
And then she showed a visual of something in nature that had the exact same pattern.
Yes.
And then she did this like 20 times. She showed like a pattern that had been created by a very specific frequency or timbre of a sound.
Uh-huh.
And then automatically showed the what that corresponded to in nature. And I just got it that every single thing in nature, every single physical shape has the message that creates it,
right.
comes from a harmonic structure of sound, which is a certain type of tone.
Right, or patterns of sounds.
Uh-huh,
I like
right.
to think that, you know, we tend to think in terms of just single sounds, but obviously
right.
each molecule really is a whole symphony, if you will, and so we're made up of how many quadrillions and gazillions of cells and molecules and so forth, excuse me.
Yeah.
So you know, it's really, you know, symphonies upon symphonies of sound, each with different phases and amplitudes and frequencies and an incredible dynamic of relationships. But overall, if you take something that's more monotonic, if like a very refined crystal, for example, that's carefully grown, then you can start talking about things that have very, for example, very specific sets of frequencies along certain axes of alignment and so forth. So then you know, with a quartz crystal, you have a fundamental frequency that is probably more predominant than any other modes that it can oscillate in. But you still have harmonics, though. And so even with, the structures that we have, we, in our bodies, we're capable of just an almost unimaginable range of harmonics, because we can think about just about anything. And even with the limited biological equipment that we have as humans, we can still go to a lot of places pretty fast. I mean, we can think of a distant galaxy instantaneously, which is where I think modern physics gets kind of fun, because it's showing us that with the non-locality, if you will, of the field, our thoughts really literally do jump across the seeming boundaries of space-time, just like the paired electrons that has been. The quantum entanglement, as it's called, has been replicated so many different times in the laboratory that shows that you can take two electrons from the same electron pair and change the axis of spin on one, and the other one in that pair changes its spin to match it instantaneously, not at the speed of light or 100 times or 1,000, but instantaneously. So that's like, okay, there it is, you know, everything I think or say or do touches all the universe. And right now, you know, not just, you know, at the speed of light or whatever, but we're all interconnected. And in this maze of frequencies, this myriad of waves and frequencies. And like you say, each one of them has a characteristic pattern, and yet the patterns are representative of a deeper principle that goes beyond form and pattern.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, since I teach sound and I teach the harmonic structure, and the harmonic structure is a mathematical relationship that is mathematical multiples that is found, they say, in the distance between the planets,
mm-hmm.
It's all
mm-hmm.
found at the quantum level,
right.
And the energy levels, it's found throughout nature, but not nearly as much as the golden mean. And I was always curious if there's a relationship between the harmonic structure, which is 1 times, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, and the golden mean.
Well, in terms of the integer whole number relationship in the harmonics, and then the phi harmonics.
Yeah, there's some relationship, because I think of it as just two completely separate patterns now.
Well,
maybe
it's interesting.
Not,
yeah, and you mentioned, actually, I think one of the places where they sort of converge is in the, like, for example, the plant kingdom. You mentioned the Fibonacci series, because the plant and animal and human kingdoms, if you will, have a lot of Fibonacci numbers. The plant spirals are a really good example, because if you look at how plants grow, what's called the phylotaxis of plants, they start out as integer numbers, and the more diversity or the more growth there is, the closer and the more developed and the higher number of leaves and so forth, the closer you get to that idealized golden ratio proportion.
Interesting. So they actually start with the harmonic structure.
Sure, because it's 1 and 1 and then 2 and then 3 and then 5 and then 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you analyze the angle at which the leaves occur going around the stem of a plant, very often, not always, but very often, they're in the proportion, if you divide a circle into a phi proportion. In other words, one part of the circle is relatively 1, and the other part is 1.618. If you divide, you can figure out what that angle is. And that angle occurs again and again throughout the plant kingdom. And they found that the reason that is so effective is because it maximizes the amount of sunlight that each leaf gets. So it's basically helping plants in the foliage and in the natural world optimize the amount of sunlight.
It's so funny. I've had this one plant that I've got in my room here that's like over 10 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
And I've always tied it up because it spreads out too much. And ever since I've heard that that's how how it works is they're just they're using the sacred geometry to spread out.
Right.
Just let it go, and it's really kind of gone, kind of taken over the room. But I just love to look at it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Now there's one part that I think is the most interesting thing that you do, and you mentioned it at the beginning, and that is, how do you get compassion? How do you get to compassion out of sacred geometry?
Yeah, again, I think it's more a reminder, and I try. I think what initially got me into sacred geometry and this universal proportion is just that very nature of universality. I keep looking for things that are true no matter who you are, no matter where you are, no matter what time or space, or you know, going beyond cultural boundaries and all that sort of thing. So to me, mathematics is a great place to start because, you know, the square root of 9 is 3, regardless of what planet or galaxy you're on. And so the geometric metaphor, I think, is like, again, a reflection of the principle of compassion, the principle of kindness.
That we're all the same.
Yeah, that we're all the same. And it's really, I think, a reflection, if you will, that we find in the manifest world of shapes and forms and that sort of thing, that there's a harmony and an order that is a reflection or a shadow or, you know, an effect, if you will, of that greater harmony. So, you know, we tend to think that, and there's nothing wrong with putting yourself in an environment that has all those proportions and you know, optimal resonances for everything. But it seems to me it's sort of like getting the cart before the horse instead of the heart before the course, to make a little wordplay there. If we can remember that the feeling that we have, as Neville would say, is the secret, and the feeling of wanting to be in a state of compassion and resonance with all others, seeming others outside ourselves, that then provides the mechanism and automatically attunes us in the same way that just toning, you know, the experience I had of toning in the Great Pyramid, I didn't have to, you know, spend all afternoon with a lot of equipment and everything. I just kind of let my intuitive self kind of kick in and say, okay, there's got to be a resonant frequency here. And you know, within a second or two, there it was. And I think the same thing is true with us. You know, when we relate to each other with the letting go of grievances and a sense of forgiveness, of letting go of the space-time constraints that we put ourselves and each other under, that, like Gary Renard stuff, you know, talks about quantum forgiveness, gets us into that mode where naturally, and I think if we were to measure it, we'd discover that people that are in that state of being in the zone or bliss or grace, whatever you want to call it, naturally have those rhythms and you know, the lower blood pressure, the more what do they call it, the heart rate variability is more optimal. All those kinds of things are a byproduct rather than a cause of that awareness. Yeah. And the beauty of that is you don't need the technology, but the technology is kind of fun to play with as a mirror of the resulting awareness, it would seem.
You know, it seems like I often talk about, it seems like where we're headed, if we're all going into higher consciousness now, where we're headed is to in a place where we are all one.
Right.
And it sounds like what you're saying is this is a gateway. This you can use the sacred geometry as a gateway to getting to that place.
I think so. I think, it, again, it's more of a mnemonic. Just like you can really use anything. If you listen to the radio and you hear a lyric that says, "Oh yeah, that's reminding me that, you know, that there's you know, no reason to you know, like Bobby McFerrin, you know, don't worry, be happy."
So like basically, it's like anything when you hear any resonance with anything.
Exactly.
That's kind of the core of it.
Yeah, and you can even use things that appear to be discordant as reminders to say, okay, well, what is it that I'm having an issue with there? If the nature of physical reality is that we are overly, obsessively, compulsively identified with our bodies and the little tiny speck of space-time that we occupy, and we allow something that is as trivial as the events of our life to get us out of kilter, you know, like that two-step procedure that I forget who coined this, but I really like is, you know, there's two steps. Is one is don't sweat the small stuff, and two, it's all small stuff. You know, it's like, yeah. And I think when we can laugh about the folly of identifying with our thoughts and our drama and our stories, and just say, okay, is it worth getting upset about this? Or, you know, what am I really getting out of being out of sorts in any capacity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's a mild irritation or full blown, you know, upset, you know, trauma, then we can look at ourselves and say, all right, what is the frequencies that I'm generating? And we don't have to get out an oscilloscope any kind of a techno gadget, although those are fun to play with, and they can certainly be a great feedback tool to show us when we're resonating with that state of peace or not. And there's a lot of different wonderful technologies that can do that. There's nothing wrong with those things. I think it's just if we try to think that those are going to get us there, you know, I think we might be barking up the wrong tree a little bit, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's great. It's, you know, it seems like it's the best thing about geometry and such is shows you perspective.
Exactly.
And if you can always just zoom out on any situation, whether it's emotional or any personal situation, if you zoom out far enough, you can always get to a place. Basically, mostly you go to a place of compassion.
Yeah.
And then it's like you just said, you know, then it's all small.
Exactly. And you don't even have to go to out to the galaxy level. You mean just look at our planet. I mean, I think when the astronauts landed on the moon and started showing us photographs of our planet, and we all had this collective understanding that, oh, we're sharing this little jewel of a planet. And you look back and you see this blue thing floating in the blackness of space, as we perceive it anyway, although it's probably filled with frequencies of light our little one-octave vision doesn't show us. But even still, that beautiful little jewel that we all inhabit together gives us the perspective of, okay, we're on this, it's not really a sphere, it's a spheroid, you know, flattened at the poles, but close enough to a sphere in terms of the geometry. And a sphere is a wonderful metaphor because it is the shape that says, what kind of egalitarian awareness can I bring to bear in my life that gives me, and what a perfect shape for sound and healing too. I mean, the music of the spheres, the harmony of something that no matter where you are on the surface of that, you have the same importance, the same equality as every other point on that sphere, regardless of what angle or direction you go in. And then ultimately, again, if we collapse space and time, we're either at a point, which is the quantum level of the singularity, if you will, that Nassim Haramein and one of my colleagues that I admire his work talks about, or if you take it to infinity, you have an infinite sphere, or maybe it's a dodecahedron, we're at the end of the edge of the universe, but that idea that, you know, if we encompass everything, that all-encompassing awareness, then a sphere is not a bad place to start as a geometric metaphor that we can wrap our minds around. Yeah.
You know, I want to mention your website again because, you know, I think your website, I've just done searches for sacred geometry. When I come across yours,
uh-huh.
It seems that the simplest and most clear, because it's so easy to get, you know, to go out on a branch.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is.
And it seems like I really highly recommend your website.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've had a lot of fun with it over here, and I always enjoy getting comments from people. I also have a mailing list, which is growing daily, and you can just click on the subscribe button there and add yourself to that.
And you've also got some booklets you put together.
I do. I have a book that's been out about a decade called Sacred Geometry Design Source Book, and a number of other little products I'm working on, it, and also some video patterns for people who use Final Cut Pro, if there are any Mac video editors out there, as well as a bunch of other little things I'm working on. And there's also a German edition that one of my customers in Austria was nice enough to transcribe the book, which is mostly patterns, and I'm working on the second book called The Geometry Code, and that's the name of the website. There's a wonderful friend who I've yet to meet, although we've had lots of conversations on the phone and email, and he and I a year ago created a wonderful screensaver that's based on his brilliant technology. I just sent a few line art patterns, and he colored them and animated them, and so we have now a geometry code screensaver that goes along with his light source screensaver that was partly inspired by my book, and his name's Mika Feinberg. But if you go to geometrycode.com, you'll see a whole bunch of stuff there. There's free patterns that you can download and print that have the Platonic solids and the Archimedean solids. There's 5 and 13 of each of those, which are also Fibonacci numbers, interestingly enough.
Play with them with your kids.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're great. They're great for kids. In fact, I just put together a little proposal for the local, it's the company called ScienceWorks that has science hands-on stuff. And so maybe I'll be doing a little summer class for kids there. So we'll see where that goes. But I love sharing this kind of stuff with people. So if anybody wants to, you know, get in touch with me, any way I can help with that is always welcomed. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate being able to be on your show and workshop and the seminar down south was fabulous. We just had so much fun and met. I got to meet a lot of people I've been wanting to meet for years kindred souls, and again that sense of resonance that. You know, sharing that intention to kind of tie it into the beginning of the hour.
Well, yeah. As we close, we'll hold that frequency once again of resolving duality.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll hold that frequency, and everyone that's listening, you can hold that frequency of that and that sacred geometry image of that into the evening, into the rest of the weekend, into the rest of the week, into the rest of the months ahead,
yeah,
the years ahead, and lifetimes ahead.
Yeah, pick whatever symbol works for you, whether it's a sphere or spiral or a pentagram or, you know, shapes that you feel comfortable with are a perfect place to start.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
All right, take care.
You too. Have a nice evening.